Sarvanga Sarvanga
Sarvanga Sarvanga Sarvanga
Isha Mudvahana Dina
Isha Mudvahana Dina
Karotya Viratang Murho
Karotya Viratang Murho
Duritani Durasaya
Duritani Durasaya.
It is a perverted reflection of the family in Krishna Loka. In Krishna Loka, there are also family, friends, society, father, mother. Everything is there, but they are eternal. Here we change bodies, our family relationships also change as we change our bodies. Sometimes we are in a family of human beings, sometimes in a family of demigods, sometimes a family of cats, or sometimes a family of dogs. Family, society, and friendship are flickering, and so they are called asat. It is said that as long as we are attached to this asat, temporary non-existing society and family, we are always full of anxieties. The materialists do not know that the family, society, and friendship here in this material world are only shadows, and thus they become attached. Naturally, their hearts are always burning, but in spite of all inconvenience, they still work to maintain such false families because they have no information of the real family association with Krishna. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta Swami translation purport to text 7, chapter 30, canto 3 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. In these verses, which the chapter is entitled Description of Adverse Fruitive Activities, now it's explaining the problems intrinsic in Grihamedi life, the family life centered around sense gratification. In the next verse, Prabhupada describes Grihastha life, which we'll read tomorrow. Grihastha refers to one who lives with family, wife, and children, but whose real purpose of life is to develop Krishna consciousness. One is therefore advised to become a Grihastha and not a Grihamedi. If the goal of one's life is how to accumulate material happiness, how to have a stable condition of sense gratification, to have children so that one can enjoy the children, the good fame of the children, their success and so on. The whole idea is all the mundane sides. And actually, there's so much anxiety. And flying here, we read in a newspaper, it says that in Korea, the children don't get any sleep. Because the parents stay up with the children to push them to study more and more, to become technologically advanced. That even they stay in the school till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. The parents give them caffeine injections and keep them up till midnight so they can really study and get ahead. And the parents are, you know, along with it, studying with them the algebra and the and everything, really pushing. So much anxiety for this achieving. Also, just as I was leaving Madras, some unfortunate news in Madras that and the parents are pushing lately the kids so much, and that two girls who had just taken their final exams for their school leaving, they were in so much anxiety that they didn't do well in the exam, and to face the humiliation of having failed their exam, so they committed suicide. Remember last time I came to, not last time, but sometime when I came to Australia, one of the times, that it was a big poll. I haven't read any newspapers in Australia this time, so I don't know the latest of it. That time it was, some poll was there, and it described how the majority of the most major cause for death in teenagers in Australia was suicide. Which kind of symbolizes the extreme frustration that people feel in trying to maintain something which is not natural. If it was natural, then why would you be so frustrated and want to take your life? The people don't know what is a natural situation. And another, I think it's a little earlier in the third canto, there's a description about, maybe it's, I don't remember exactly where, but there's a description that the real purpose of family life, one real purpose, there's a lot of different real purpose, but one real purpose is to have children who will perform the Srat ceremony, or the offering of worship to Lord Krishna for the upliftment of the departed parents. Offer the worship to Krishna, and the results of that are given to the, on behalf of the soul of the departed parent. So that the parents are delivered from some hellish condition. In case they are stuck up in a hellish condition next life, then their descendants would save them from that condition by performing devotional service to Krishna, at least ritually once every year, and offering the remnants of Krishna prasadam to the parents, departed soul. And the example was there in the Bhagavatam that how indeed that because that had happened, a parent who was in a very hellish condition had become delivered because the descendants had performed that sacrifice. So previously the families would be trying to imbibe the children with religious and moral and principles, and to imbibe them with the responsibility to take, to be spiritually and religiously active, and to be responsible for one's forefathers, at least. Now, if the parents didn't train the children in spiritual life, then they would become, they wouldn't take that type of spiritual responsibility very seriously. So there was a lot of spiritual orientation to the training. Nowadays that doesn't seem to be the preoccupation of the parents. That what the children will do in the next life. Sometimes there's preoccupation what the children will do in this life. When, as many years ago, there was that Korean airliner that got shot down by the Soviets during the time of the Soviet Union. And I happened to be in Malaysia at that time, and there was a Malaysian on board, that a Chinese student who had just got college graduation, maybe post-graduation, and was heading back to Malaysia. They asked the parents what they thought about the deceased son. And their comment was, we had invested so much money in putting him through college, and we were depending that he'd come back and he would maintain us, get a good job, and now he's dead, so how will we maintain? So it was like a very... there are many things you could say, but they were, that was their particular perspective on it. It was like an investment gone wrong or something. So, amongst all this, it's become very bewildering. What should be the attitude? And sometimes we read these very heavy verses, and then we wonder, what is the proper frame? Does this mean we should just give up all our family responsibilities and everyone should take sannyas or something? That's obviously not what Prabhupada is meaning by this. And of course, someone, a brahmachari, might be inspired to try, make a go for it. But by and large, people are going to choose or are already in the household life. But how to actually see those relationships in a different perspective, to build a relationship on a higher basis with a higher purpose of actually pleasing Krishna. We were walking with Srila Prabhupada one day in Mayapur, and he would take a morning walk, and there's a system used in Bengal, it's probably used all over India, that of course, now many people use this electronic threshing machines. But another way of threshing the grains is, this was mung and urid, like some pulse like that. So after the these pulses are harvested, they're put to dry in a kind of a platform. And then when they're sufficiently dry and the pods are brittle, so then what they do is put them on a, they have a stick, and they tie two or four bullocks to the stick, and they just drive them, and they're yoked up, but then they just end up going in a circle around and around, and then on that area where the where they're going around, they put all these dry pulse plants, and the bulls kicking and running over them with says four bullocks. It's 16 feet. Is that correct? So there's a lot of kicking and stomping and. Doing that for a couple hours, it effectively separates the breaks all the pods, and it's easier than manually trying to do that. And then after that, they have their ways of sifting out the grain from the pulverized pot. So we were walking by while the farmers were driving the bullocks around. And Prabhupada asked the farmer, what is that stick called? And the farmer said, that's called the Medanda, the woman stick. And Prabhupada, then he said, just see how the bullocks are going around and around. So that's basically what the Grihamedi life is that everything is centered around the woman and the family. And maybe so many activities, but it's all centered around the sense gratification. So there's not, although it looks like there's progress, it's not actually real progress. And Grihastha life means that it's centered around Krishna, and husband and wife work together to actually please Krishna. Instead of sense gratification being the only criteria. How much sense gratification can we accumulate is the test of how much success. I think that one of these big the penthouse, some big like Playboy kind of magazine owner said that his idea of what the success of life is, who can accumulate the most toys, the most gadgets, most different kinds of little gadgets and toys. When you die with the most toys in your possession, you win. I say, well, that's his vision, the philosophy of life. How much sense gratification, like your scorecard, you know, how many points have you racked up? How many of different types of sense gratification, eating, sleeping, sex life, and so on, and how many toys you racked up? This is a very empty life. They have a lot of toys, so it looks like variety. It's like they never grow up. Now, there's actually a real purpose to life. And there's actually a real deep spiritual happiness that everyone can achieve. But generally people are so overwhelmed by the illusion that Maya is creating that they don't look beyond that. And in the previous verse here, and in the sixth chapter, the sixth verse, fifth verse rather, Prabhupada says here, by the influence of Maya, the conditioned soul becomes so affectionate towards his particular type of body that if he is offered, quote, give up this body and immediately you will have a king's body, unquote, he will not agree. This attachment strongly affects all conditioned living entities. Lord Krishna is personally canvassing, quote, give up everything in this material world, come to me, and I shall give you all protection, unquote. But we are not agreeable. We think, we are quite all right. Why should we surrender unto Krishna and go back to his kingdom? This is called illusion or Maya. Everyone is satisfied with the standard of living, however abominable it may be. Being satisfied, I mean, maybe people are not satisfied with exactly what they have, but they, that standard that they're living in, they may want to increase that, but that kind of standard is what they're happy with. They're not thinking that there's a whole other paradigm, there's a whole other vision to life. And that's where the question comes in, who is crazy? That for the materialists, they think that the devotees are they're crazy, and even very pious Brahmin Indian families, you'll find the elders saying to the young people who are taking up Krishna consciousness, "Why you're doing so much arti and this puja? You know, don't be too religious. Japa every day, and you can do this when you get old." Now enjoy life and then do a little, you know, little prayer is good. Yes, we also, a little bit, but not too much. Because they're thinking that the happiness is all this sense gratification. They don't see that there's happiness in serving Krishna. That that's where the real happiness is achieved, in a much higher relationship and a higher purpose. And their thought is that, all right, it's dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Now you make your money, enjoy your sense gratification, and at the end of life, then I'll go for the moksha. But in devotional service, we know about the prema. The prema is actually, the love for Krishna is the highest perfection. And love for Krishna is actually the highest happiness also. So that there's a special juice, special rasa within that devotional service. And if someone can get a taste for that, then there's nothing that can compare with it. Now this verse, as Prabhupada, he also mentioned that well, it's actually the next verse. But in the Prabhupada, he mentions how one decides to be a grihastha. As a devotee may decide that I prefer to serve Krishna in this platform. I'd rather serve Krishna from a family situation. And there may be many reasons why one might decide that way. Not that it has to always be for the reason of just uncontrolled senses or some desire for sense gratification. There may be many reasons that might motivate one. In the case of Srinivas Acharya, he was already a liberated soul. He had already got blessings from Radharani. And when he recovered the Bhagavata, the books from the king, Birambir Bikram Shah Maharaj, and the king requested that he become his guru. In those days, to be the Raj Guru, man, you had to be a grihastha. But if he was the king's guru, then he would have a very good facility to make the whole kingdom Krishna conscious. So he was torn what to do. He didn't have any real desire to be a householder for the normal reasons that people feel. At the same time, it was some possibility for preaching. So he asked some senior Vaishnavas, yes, Narahari Thakur, what he should do. And Narahari Thakur told him that better you get be the Rajguru, you get married and be the Rajguru. And so Srinivas Acharya, he accepted the householder ashram, and he had children. Once a devotee accepts any particular ashram, then they very carefully follow the rules of that ashram. That was what Lord Chaitanya wanted. So if someone is a brahmachari, they should very carefully act as a proper brahmachari. If they're a householder, they should fulfill all the duties of a householder. And vanaprasanya is the same. So once he accepted household, he fulfilled the householder requirements. Although, since he had a Krishna conscious a family and a wife, so therefore he would spend a certain amount of time with the family, and a certain amount of time it was understood that he would go out and preach. So he would maybe even be out preaching for extended periods, weeks or months, maybe sometime even a couple of months. Communication was not so easy in those days, just walking. So his house was in near Katwa, and his the kingdom where he was the Raj Guru was quite a ways away. That was in Vishnupura. We went with the devotees to Bona Vishnupura. Not this last year, but the year before last. And we saw that Srinivasacharya had built a temple for Radha Kala Chanti Jiri. And there were deities of Radha, Madan Mohan, that were like the royal deities. And then there were 13 different temples, and for 13 generations, each descendant from the king built a new temple for the deity. So, and they all established a nice deity worship. And now those become a big tourist attraction because their terracotta temples are quite unique architecture. Small, I mean not really small, not very large. I mean maybe 80 feet high, 100 feet high, 60, 70 feet high, different. But made of terracotta. And the deities of Gaur Nithai of Srinivasacharya were also there. Of course, up to so long as the kings were kings, then things were going all right. But now there's no more kings in India. And so we spoke to one of the pujaris, saw the deities had been taken out of all the different temples and just kept in one temple. And he said, well, can't maintain all those temples worship, so it's combined here. And then there were no Radharanis, and then these were all the Radharanis. So the kings kept them in his house because he's afraid that if it's kept out here, someone will steal them because some of them are having a lot of gold in them. They're brass and gold deities. Krishna's black stone, not so much. You can't melt down the black stone, but the gold you can. So it's like, it's kind of heartbreaking, you know, that here's our... You can see, like, what it was before and how it was such a Krishna-conscious environment for so many centuries. But now it's like a shell of that. And so I got inspired that in the future we could somehow get the blessing to reactivate that whole situation. And it's real funny, the pujari was complaining. He said outside there was about $500,000 worth of high power Philips lights to show off the terracotta temple, but for inside, he said, they don't even give me a light bulb. For the deity, I had to stretch a little wire from the tea stall across the road and little bulb there for the, so it's like the shins. Maybe if a new government comes, they don't have their priorities very clear about what they're just showing the building for the tourists, but they don't, the deity, which the temple was built for the deity, that they don't spend anything on that. Anyway, that's neither here. That's not the real point here. But to show that how much, the past 100 years things have degenerated so much that. But before that, it was. I think I told you the story about the deity, Radha Madan Mohan deity, and the whole pastime of the 13th king.
The cannon
and everything. No, the canon was earlier. Canon was not the 13th. That was the 11th.
Yeah.
It was during the British rule.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. I was hearing the different, as long as Srinivasacharya was in, everything was completely Krishna conscious, and then it was big festivals, and the whole kingdom was centered around these deities, and they kept adding more festivals. But that's the problem with deity worship. You keep on making more temples, and at some point in time, it becomes difficult to maintain all the temples. wasn't necessary that every king had to make a new temple. Just could have just increased, just maintained the puja in the existing temple. And that's why we don't want to unnecessarily increase the number of temples unless there's really a congregation to maintain the temple and a need for it. It's more important to expand the congregation and the namhata and have many people chanting and practicing, which doesn't increase the overhead so much. Rather, it helps to maintain the temples. When there is enough congregation, then the temple becomes a nice facility for everyone to worship the Lord. And so there was this wonderful circumstance that we could see for so many centuries going on, even just before the British came. There was this, I told the story about how that one dacoit king had conquered over, and he was so many areas. And he kept attacking for about a dozen times, was attacking this kingdom, but he finally was defeated by the miraculous way. The king, when he saw he was being surrounded by Bhaskar Pandit, he told the whole kingdom, to the whole knight, that they should all chant. Don't fire any weapons, just chant the whole night and take the blessing of the Lord. And then, so the whole kingdom was up chanting that night. And then the Bhaskar Pandit thought, well, they're not going to fight back now, so here's our chance, let's attack them while they're vulnerable. So with his 10,000 soldiers, he moved in to attack the kingdom, and then there was this sound of cannon fire, and it sounded like about many cannons. In those days, cannons, you had to muzzle load them. It was quite a tedious process, and they had to put the fire powder in the long thing and step back and then come in with a big, Q-tip, whatever, the big thing, and pack it in again, and then, so, normally they couldn't chew, but here it was going boom, 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 like more of the modern artillery. And the king said, who's firing our cannon? I told nobody to lift any weapons and send someone out. And then they found, they said, the whole Bhaskar Pandit's army had been massacred. They've been shot by cannon fire. And then the king went out and he saw these cannons were practically red hot. They were just steaming. And the whole army of Bhaskar Pandit were just lying there, just completely devastated by this intense cannon fire. And then there was an old man sitting there, and he asked him, who did this? How did this happen? And he said, I saw that the deity came out and took this massive form, and with one cannon under each arm, he just started firing. The cannon just started going off and firing. And they went over to the temple, and they went into the deity room, and there was a smell of gunpowder. So, it's a unique pastime. But this was a very important deity, Radha Madan Mohan. I believe the deity is Radha Madan Mohan. So this deity was very much loved by all the people. Two generations, or three generations after, during the British time, there was a king. And By that time, the economy had gone down. They were like all just feudal lords under the kings. They didn't really have much under the British, didn't have much independence. Somehow he was, it's a poor area, that part of the country. I don't know why, but the king had mismanaged his finances and had gone into debt. And he didn't have enough money to pay the expenses, to meet the cash flow. So one of his ministers advised him, look, why don't you, there's a rich businessman in Calcutta, one Malik. If you, he's a great devotee, always comes out to see the deity. You could take a 300,000 rupee loan from him and give the deity as collateral. Then when you pay back, because he had no credit rating, no one gave the king you. And so the king thought, well, that's not a bad idea. Pretty ill-advised, actually. And then he asked that businessman if he'd give him a loan for the deity. And the business said, I'd do anything for these deities, you know. They're so powerful and merciful. So he said, sure. And they sign an agreement, when you give me the 300,000 back with interest, and I'll give you the deities back. And so he took off with the deities. When the kingdom people found out that the deities had been taken away, they went mad. You know, it was like throwing rotten eggs at the king and just like, you know, abusing him and, what have you done? And there's a total insurrection, you can say. And then immediately after doing this, the king really was feeling, you know, like couldn't sleep at night, and he was like, you know, he started praying, I made the biggest mistake. It's really, it could really became, his attachment to Krishna grew very much through all this. And then he somehow raised the money up and went there and gave the money, wanted to give the money to the businessman, but the businessman said, no, I don't want it. You know, we keep the money. I want the deity. He said, no, but I have the agreement. And he said, well, tough luck. You know. So then he had to go to court and fight it out in the court that I have this agreement, the deity has to be given back, and they even say that he was praying to the deity for help, and that the deity somehow inspired the lawyer how to argue. Some say the deity himself came and argued the case in a lawyer form, but I have no way. So this is the pujaris, and they have a lot of stories. So anyway, somehow the king won the case. He gave the money. I guess he deposited the money in the court, and the court ordered that he had to give the deities back. So then he gave the deities to the king, and the king was going back to Bankura in procession. And then the night he was sleeping, and the deity came in his dream and said that you don't have the real deity. I'm still with the businessman. He gave you a copy. Taking the time during the court case, he made an exact duplicate and gave to the counterfeit deities to the king, and kept the deities in his inner quarters where he was worshipping them. It's kind of like his whole tug of war over the deity. But it must have been all the devotees of the kingdom, and somehow the deity was inclined to go back to the original place. The mood of that businessman was not proper. So he was. He revealed this to the king. The king snuck back, and then he, you know, crawled over the wall, and then he came and looked in the window, and there he saw the. He's worshipping his deity. So then he got the real deities and took them back, and there was a big installation, I mean big reception, and things were all right. So those deities are still being fully worshipped. Those deities, the worship is those one deities and the original deities of Shrinivas. Those are the two deities that have full worship, and all the other king's deities have this combined, very simple worship. But that deity's worship is going on in a much higher standard. So you can see, I mean, how much the deity there was so much the center of the activities of that, not only the household, but of the whole kingdom. And the movement of the deities and everything was such a major event that it was a singular, most devastating event for the whole kingdom. Even in South India, you see how you can hear similar, not exactly similar, but amazing kind of pastimes in Guruvayur or in the Padmanabha temple. That they have a massive processions every with a Utsavamurti every year to the ocean and bathe the deity and come back. And every 6 years they have a very big procession. In Sri Rangam they have many such festivals. And this year we went to the Singhachalam in Andhra Pradesh, and there in Visakhapatnam we. There's the Baraha Narsingha deity. And the deity is 8 million years old. Was in manifest in the Satyayuga before the last Satyayuga. And Prahlad wanted to see the form of the Lord that had killed his uncle. Baraha, so Narsingha Dev manifested a Baraha Narsingha form with the head of Baraha and the body of Narsingha. So it's a very unique deity, and the deity is in a very Ugra form. So they keep the deity covered by sandal paste the whole year. And I went there with Bhakti Brijendranand Maharaj and about 50 devotees, and one day a year they take off the sandalwood pulp, and then for 6 hours you can see the deity. I mean, probably the deity after 8 million years may not have, I don't know how many details are there. I may be a little worn, but so we went, and all you see, it's just like a big, almost like a linga or a big shaligram of gigantic of sandalwood, a big cone. But when the devotees went, everyone they commented just by coming in the presence of the deity, everyone is feeling happy. Bhakti Brijendranand Maharaj, he was, I feel so happy, I feel so happy. It's like his. Everyone was feeling very blissful being there. So when that deity's darshan is open for that 6 hours, that one day, so millions of people are lining up to see the deity that time. Then Tirupati, of course, all year long, people are going, when they have their special festival, Brahma Mohotsav, then there's sometimes people used to wait in the queues for days to get a darshan. No, they have this elaborate darshan system. You wait in a big waiting areas. Your turn to get a darshan. So one way, of course, is like the centering the life around the deity. And there are many pastimes like that. Another way of just centering your life around the whole process of Krishna consciousness and the spreading and preaching Krishna consciousness. So the family can also be oriented in a Krishna conscious way. And that actually creates a greater unity, because there's one focus. I remember seeing a little cartoon, one of those Bumstead or something. He said, let's go to the movies. We have a family out there together. We'll all enjoy together. So they go, now the modern movies, it's about seven different movies in one, five or seven. I don't know what it's like in Australia or America. It's like that. You get that thing. So when they went there, then the daughter wanted to go to this one, and the son wanted to go to the kung fu one, and the mother wanted to go to the love one, and then he wanted to go to the action one. He said, what happened to the family? Everybody went on to the different movie. But that's what Priyamani life means. Everyone has their own senses, and they all have their own interests. And so it becomes almost competitive, and they may compromise, work together, that's to try to find some compatibility. At least they have a similar interest, but it's very hard to get it all lined up. But if Krishna is the center, then it's much easier. Unify on serving Krishna. Even if one's material tastes and interests are different, but that spiritually that's a common ground. So although it may seem, how such harsh words here about family life, then how can a Krishna conscious family be more successful? But it can be much more successful. It's the basic problems with the material family life that create all this envy and dissatisfaction and burningness. Because if your whole goal is sense gratification, then there's always a limit how much our senses can be gratified. They're never fully satisfied. So then someone seems like they're happy next door. They have a bigger swimming pool or a bigger facility or better saris or something. And then why we can't have like they have, in the way they call it in America, keeping up with the Joneses. I don't know what they call here, keeping up with the Smiths. And that the satisfaction grows and grows until people become so frustrated. Of course, nowadays, divorced, they were just materially very attached to the whole situation. Where nowadays, many, they don't even achieve this success of Griyamani life. Which is not the biggest loss, but the real point is that people should center around Krishna, should have a spiritual purpose to their life. And if somebody decides that they want to be a householder, their household, then they should play that particular role very responsibly and try to do it in such a way that the children are Krishna conscious, the family is Krishna conscious. If someone says, there's a lot of responsibility, actually householder life is very responsible life. Someone rather is able to just concentrate on preaching and being a brahmachari. Well, that's very good. That's also an option. The point in our Krishna conscious movement is that to get everyone, not that we're trying to promote that people just artificially, Lord Chaitanya never wanted anyone to artificially renounce. So this is, it's not worth it. It's not of any practical purpose. The real purpose is to become attached to Krishna. And that we'll do by doing devotional service to Krishna. Like generally, householders who are not Krishna conscious, they say, why should I, what do I have to gain? You know, this is like trying to figure out materially how will this improve my sense gratification. Well, that's where like in the Vedas, they try to entice the materialistic householders with many, like this last month was the Vaishakha month, and so in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, it mentions how of all the months, Vaishakha is the most important. In fact, according to the Hindi calendar, there's still about 4 or 5 days left of Vaishakh month. According to the Vaishnav, Madhava month is over. So, but Vaishakha is all mentioned. Said of all bodies of water, the ocean is the most important in this planet. So similarly, of all the months, the Vaishakh month is the most important. If you take a holy bath in the month of Vaishakh, it's worth, in the month of Magha, it's worth 1,000 times more than normally. And if you do in the month of Vaishakh, it's worth 100 times more than Magha. And on that month, everything we do, there's so much more benefit. And that, again, I don't particularly remember all the karma kanda, but many kind of perks are there. Good health, good children, devotional children, parents that don't have children. Oh, that's for Nrisingha Chaturdasi. If you worship Nrisingha Chaturdasi, you get all kinds of, householders get all kinds of obstacles removed, and good children, things like that. But then it says the real purpose is the higher purpose is you also get pure devotion. So like Vaishakh says, also a month you can get devotion very easy for the Lord. And there was a story about the glories of Vaishakh month mentioned in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, referred to from the Padma Purana, how there was a Muni. If I remember, it was like Mundaka, maybe it was the same Mundaka Muni, but it was some, a name like that. Might not have been. And he was worshipping in his ashram, meditating, and all of a sudden the Yamadutas came and tied up his subtle body and yanked him out of his body and took him away to Yamaloka. He said, what happened? You know, it's like he was completely shocked. And there he sees these, you know, really heavy characters, the Yamadutas, are ferocious, strong. And then he gets taken over to the court of Yamaraj, and he sees like all these personified diseases, tuberculosis, cancer, probably was AIDS there too, but diarrhea, and it mentioned all piles, it mentioned it's different. Like Yamaraj decided, like a whole agents of disease. All right, give this one piles. Take over this one. It didn't exactly describe what the personified disease would look like, but they're recognizable. And then these kind of ferocious animal, intelligent animal, like lions with blood's ready to on the word, okay, jump and tear, and then all kinds of gruesome kind of different entities that I don't know exactly what the that ghouls, gaul, you know, that kind of things. Don't know exactly. They didn't have a good translation. I don't know how to translate it. Just far out kinds of entities that are dwarf and muscular and with the fangs and hair in their face and just kind of so they're all fired up. I mean, they were not timid. The Yamadutas are quite proactive in their approach and were ready to execute the order of Yamaraj enthusiastically to torture and give the appropriate medicine. So here they had brought this Muni, and the Rishi was standing there, you know, like, you know, in his subtle body, and like, you know, what's happening? You know? What did I do? And then he finally, amongst all this big crowd of all the Yamaraja crew, then he sees Yamaraj. It was like took a while to kind of focus, and then he sees like Yamaraj just comes and sits on his seat, and he's in a raised seat, and he's like quite intelligent, quite presence in Yamaraj. Yamaraj looks and he tells the Yamadutas, this is the wrong one. You brought the wrong, it's the same name, but it's the wrong person. I told you to bring Manduka, the son of so-and-so, the Kshatriya, and not the son of this person, the Brahmana. He's not one of our candidates. This is the wrong one. The Brahmana. It's one of those. Glad there was a mistaken identity there. And then they said, but we went looking for the person you told us, and we couldn't see anyone of that description that was ready to die. And we thought this person had the same name, so we thought it must have been him. And when Yamaraj meditated for a minute and said, oh, that king had observed the chanting. If you do japa, you do the vrata, the bathing, and different things in the month of Vaishak, you become invisible to Yamadutas. And then Rishis, I'm going to do Vaishak. Vrata, he started telling everybody, and then after that he would never miss a Vaishak. He wanted to be invisible to the Yamadutas. Didn't want to go back to that place. Usually you go to hell, you forget about it, because when you're born, you know, you forget all about it. But here he had this kind of gone as a visitor and got sent back, so he had the full, he could get kind of a little bit of a tour there. And he decided he didn't want to go back there again. So he told people about the glories of Vaishak, the first month of that month. So it was a good month. We practiced in this month. Well, depending which way you calculate the month, the last few days now, if we do by the normal procedure. So the scriptures give householders and everyone some attraction like that. But the actual purpose is that by doing those different sacrifices and vratas, if they actually develop attachment to Krishna and start to do it spontaneously, that's where Lord Chaitanya is giving us the mercy. That actually by chanting the names of Lord Chaitanya and chanting Hare Krishna, we start to experience real happiness in Krishna consciousness very quickly. And that's what makes it so wonderful. But initially you have to deal with people who are not so much inclined. They don't see the reason why they should do it. And that's where the preaching comes in. Of course, in Kali Yuga, it's hellish enough that there are reasons given by Maya. There's a lot of frustration. So that background does make it a little easier to preach to people. If people were really well off and didn't have any suffering, then it makes them more proud. So that's why even suffering sometimes is an impetus for our spiritual development. But if somebody without suffering, if they come to Krishna consciousness, then that's, Krishna says the Vamanadeva said that's the symptom of his special mercy. Even if they have all kinds of opulence, but they still remain attached to Krishna. So that's his special mercy. Not that he has to take everything away and make a person realize the temporary nature of it all and then give it back afterwards. Krishna gives it back if he takes it away, even a bit more than what he took, but that's not his special mercy. That's not his top mercy. That's a mercy that he sometimes does if someone's really stuck up. But if someone uses everything for Krishna, that's his special mercy. And And there's no reason of taking anything away. So we want people should learn how to use everything for Krishna. Be spiritually happy. Prabhupada said we want everyone to be happy in general, be purified from the contamination of this material world, and be eligible to go back home, back to God at the end of this life. So this is our agenda. Let everyone be happy in general, peaceful, and practice Krishna consciousness and become purified and eligible to go back to Godhead after this life. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Any question? Hare Bo.